Well, I do have to tell you guys, I'm so happy to speak with you about Roof. I didn't know what to expect with this film. Sal, an amazing job.
Yes.
Your first feature directorial. You
Thank you so much.
paid so much attention to the details in this film. You're on a rooftop. You ain't got shit up on that rooftop to work with. And you've got to keep it visually interesting. You smartly
Yep.
bring in Jonathan Pope as your DP. I am a huge fan of Jonathan's just based on what he did for John Berardo for The Mannequin, which is a horror film. But there again, he was working with a loft for about 80% of the film. But he at least had some set dress. You have a broken fire hose, and you worked wonders. But you bring in, I have to commend the makeup process, because as they are up on the roof, we start seeing the lips cracking. We see the tar and the dirt under the fingernails. Bella's face, skin in particular, the cheeks and the face is getting red with sunburn because it is the 4th of July weekend. It's damn hot and they're on a roof and sun is reflecting back on them as well as from the sky. Just these little details. And then you bring in all this metaphor, particularly with Dev, as he's going from this pompous moron who is so obsessed with the idea of getting rich and wealth. And slowly, we see the jacket come off. We see the expensive belt come off. We see the ex very expensive shoes come off. Ultimately, we get to the lighter and the watch, his father's items that I think that really was like tacitly burdening him. You take us through this so we see character development through the visuals, through actual dialogue and performance, but it's all these details that make this film so damn interesting. It holds your attention, and I love it.
That's amazing. Thank you so much for the words and the recap of that. I just wanted to add too that a lot of those details, really what those are is you highlighting all the different departments that came to the table and were able to execute and push in the direction of making the film the best it could be. So thank you for recognizing and highlighting that. And then aside from the departments in the production execution itself, working with Josh writing this, a lot of that was baked into the script itself, right? A lot of that was how do we make sure that we're not missing any piece, we're not leaving any plot holes in ways that we can to not invalidate the story itself, and then ultimately allow you to give into that world and believe in these characters and be there for their journey, right?
On every level. So I'm going to start here now with you, Josh. Where did the idea for this story arise, and what was your process to developing this script? It's like, hey, we got a roof. We got two people on a roof. Where do you go from there?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. It has a very inauspicious beginning. Sal and I would often have lunch together at work when we both worked at Bad Robot. And we would just sit around saying, wouldn't this be a cool movie? Or wouldn't that be a cool movie? And everyone would just sort of like spitball ideas for a movie. And then one day we were talking about the movie The Hangover. And we were like, what happened to the guy while he was on the roof? That's the whole like plot twist at the end is that, he was just locked out on the roof the whole time. And then we thought that was kind of a funny idea, and we just started extrapolating from that. And then originally, the script was about one man stuck on that roof, and it was much more existentialist. He goes crazy. He starts talking to a bird, and it was very much about the destruction of identity. It was sort of our core theme. And then I clearly remember the call we had with Brian Burke, who also used to work with us at Bad Robot. He's like, guys, you need someone else in the movie. You can't have a one-man monologue for 88 minutes, which is there is a script where it is a one-man monologue for 88 minutes. So we started thinking about, well, what other thematic elements could we bring in that would be expressed in a character that would deepen the story? And it went from being the sort of existentialist idea about the destruction of identity to this idea of taking a journey from selfishness to selflessness, which we think is, as human beings, is a critical journey that we you know should go through, and many of us do go through. And we expressed it in Dev in the way that you described earlier, and then we expressed it in Bella in the way she deals with her child. And the minute that happened, the minute we sort, you know, as with all things creative, they very often happen, but, you know, there's an accident that sort of is the tipping point. And then you're like, then you start piling on, and then you start realizing you have something that you're on a path that interests you. And from there it became, you know, 6 months really of just me and Sal talking every week, and I was writing and he was giving me ideas, and we were just sort of trading, you know, we were on the phone all the time and over email all the time. And then, you know, that created one version of the script. And then when we get on, you know, then we get on set and we hired Asif Ali, who is a brilliant comedian. And, you know, I remember reading this about Woody Allen years ago. He's like, you know, these are the lines, but if you have something else you want to say, you can say that too. And I just think that's a great way to give actors freedom. And Sal told that to Asif. And so some of the funnier lines in the movie, as much as I'd like to take credit for them, they're Asif's. You know, in the moment, he said, you know, this or that. So it was, you know, the development process, it was long. It was a solid year and a half, probably, of us talking through it before we arrived at, you know, the day one of shooting. And, but, you know, and then it was Asif's contribution. And then it was, of course, you know, Julian's contribution when we edited the movie. The movie, believe it or not, is we shot the movie in order, but the scenes are not in perfect order that we shot them. There is, you know, I don't know the sequences of it, but we realized, you know, you can, I think Sal agrees with this, you can never be precious with your own work. You have to let the work decide what it wants to be, and then you have to be humble enough to follow that. And that ended up involving some reorganization of the story to the point where it is now where, you know, the cut we, you know, you saw is like, okay, we're happy with this. This is telling the story we wanted to tell in the way we wanted to do it with the means we had. And now go with God. Like, let's have audiences see this movie. And, you know, there's it's out of your hands now. You know, I can't speak for Sal, but it's always a little terrifying before you talk to someone who's seen your movie because you have no idea what they think about it. And it's, you know, it's an important thing to you as a person who created it. So I'm thrilled that you enjoyed the film. It's always, honestly, the best thing you can hear from anyone. It's just that you enjoyed your movie. And you're like, thank God, because that's what we wanted out of it.
Well, and I definitely enjoy the movie, but beyond enjoying the movie, I can enjoy a movie, but then it has all kinds of structural and production issues with cinematography or with editing. Here,
sure.
I don't see, there is none of that. You have paid attention. That hour, that year and a half work you put in before you went into production, and then working in post with Julian. And I think Julian's worked with a lot of the previs editing that he used to do. And I think still does. I think that really pays off because you have some beautiful, beautiful editing sequences here. You make great use of superimpositions, which I think filmmakers don't take advantage of enough because it adds a really nice cinematic element to a film, especially an indie film. You want it to rank up there with the big boys who have $300 million budgets. So you've got some beautiful superimpositions happening here, some nice montages, that third act montage, and I'm not going to give it away, but you're in slow motion, and then you also, in the sound, there's dialogue, but it's slowed down, and it's almost like faintly in the background because of what's happening visually. And the camera is coming in closer and closer. Jonathan does a great job with bringing it in for ECUs and some extreme ECUs on eyes. So you really employ all of the cinematic elements in the toolbox to tell this story. And it's just so beautifully done.
Working with Bad Robot, you know, being close to the flame on some of the stuff that JJ's even done, you know, there was an emphasis on really kind of trying to look behind the curtain and understand what matters, right? What really matters in filmmaking and where should you spend the time? And in our case, where should you also spend the money since it's limited? And that was our goal the entire time, which is, everything that you're doing, I don't care if it's the set design, the props, the lighting, it's all an opportunity to help tell the story, right? And that's what we were trying to be intentional about, is how can every, even something as small, and I'm sure 99% of people won't catch this, as Bella having a pretty neutral outfit, but within her purse, there's a lot of red elements, the cigarettes, the lining of the purse. Those are intentional, this idea of like this like inner confidence that she has always had. She just has to like believe in herself by the end of the film. You know what I mean? So every little piece that we can try to infuse intentionality and storytelling, we did that. We tried to do that.
Well, I think you definitely succeeded with that. Now, I've got to talk to you, Sal, about your work with Jonathan Pope, and the cinematography. And this is also where your production designer with Charity Honeycutt's work comes into play, with what is on that roof that Jonathan can then turn around and keep adding visual interest, because people are going to get bored really quick if we got two people sitting on a roof in the same spot for 4 days.
But
that's not what happens. We get a variety of visuals. You make the most of angles and little things like the fire hose. It sparks references to Die Hard.
Yes.
And you've got a couple
scenes. That is not an accident. That is not an accident. We talked about Die Hard a lot.
Well, considering you got the fire hose and you've got a vent. Immediately.
Yep. Yep.
You've got your Die Hard. You've also, using the window cleaner bucket that is down on the ground, or almost to the ground, I immediately went to Martin Campbell's cleaner with Daisy Ridley.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got these great cinematic references in here. And as I'm watching, I knew that they were purposeful, especially the fire hose.
Yeah.
But you bring...
I think that's also a little bit of like, you know, the love of filmmaking that Josh and I have is like, those are films that we admire, you know, things that we think worked well and we wanted to, you know, kind of pay a little bit of homage to. So there is a little bit of that for sure that comes across in it. As far as the question you asked about working with John, that was an incredible experience. You know, he was on board very early with the idea that there were going to be many limitations that we had up on this rooftop, especially when it comes to lighting itself.
Yeah.
And I know that a lot of DPs want all the time in the world to set up their shots and light it the way they want and make it look exactly the way it's supposed to. But also supposed to is a subjective thing as well. You know, we wanted to try to lean into the grittiness, understand that it was going to be limited to what we could get across and get done. So a lot of bounce cards, a lot of, flags to shade stuff, but not a lot of literal lighting within it, other than, you know, nighttime stuff. So he was just on board early. And then also you mentioned it about like just being stuck on the roof for 90 minutes and how do you make that interesting? We tried to make a crescendo across the film that starts out with that follows our characters, right? It's like these isolated, a lot of negative space, very far apart shots in the beginning of the film with them. And also a lot of times even the blocking itself where early on in the film, they're sitting on an air vent, kind of waiting around, and their bodies are literally facing away from each other, right?
Yeah.
All the way to then kind of progressing where we get a little bit closer, a little tighter, and then obviously there's moments where they're, you know, face-to-face and extreme close-ups throughout the film. So that was one intentional piece, and then another one was just the color grading and trying to see is there a way that we can start out a little bit more washed out and bleached vibe on the roof and then kind of move it into a little bit more of a, you know, golden hour cinematic feel throughout the film. So John, I owe a lot of that to John. He was on board with that idea and that process. We were very close on set working together every step of the way to make sure we were getting the shots we needed in the time frame we had. You know, we were shooting 9 pages a day, which was crazy. Yeah, we were able to kind of shoot it a little docu-style in a way, but not with it feeling documentary style. More so just the practicality of how you're setting up the lights and the crew.
Now, I've got to ask you, because there is so little in terms of accoutrement and props that you have on a roof, how much of that was actually there? Did they really have a broken fire hose? Did they really have a broken water spigot to turn
it
on?
They did not have it. That was the production department coming, you know, coming in for us and building the box that Dev climbs on to reach the window washer platform that was constructed. And then also the air vent they sit on is constructed, and the fire hose itself. That's all been constructed, including the air vent that she climbs into. That's also added in as well.
Because I was wondering, because I've been up on many, many roofs before in tall office buildings, and generally there's not a whole lot there unless you've got swamp coolers, cooling systems, things like that. But you don't have the little accoutrement. And you even keep that very scant, what they have to work with. So it's very believable that how the heck are they going to get off the roof? There's no way to get off the roof. But then you also get some comedic moments in here. The nail file, the nail clippers, that scene is priceless. And so much of that is because of Bella and Asif and their performances. I could just imagine myself there yelling, no, you're doing it too hard. You're going to break it. You're going to break the file. You're going to break it. And you hear her voice and it's rising in pitch as she's getting frustrated with him. Some really fun stuff comes out of this too. And you wouldn't think so.
Yeah, it's interesting that scene specifically, you know, it almost, in my mind, it's a little bit of a reflection of the very, one of the earlier scenes in the film when he makes the trade, right? Mm-hmm. This unreasonable trade, but there's not someone there to call him out for being, a little bit ridiculous. And in this case, he's doing a similar thing. He thinks he can control it. He thinks he's able to, you know, take control of the situation, but he can't. And there's this other person that's calling him out for it in the moment, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. All my notes on the film, and that's one of the things that I even have in my notes, is that the power position, the control position, it shifts from beginning to end. She actually is in control at the beginning. She's got the common sense. He doesn't want to listen. And slowly we start seeing more depth come in to Dev and to Mary. And there is a total shift until we get to that third act. And eventually we are leveling up the playing field emotionally. And it's just so beautiful the way you've done that. And again, so much of that I think Julian is responsible for in the editing process.
Yeah, the edit was definitely a place that we crafted and shaped a lot of it. You know, like Josh said earlier, there's full scenes that that take place out of sequence that just fit more chronologically into the emotional sense out of what we had before, and we moved those around to just kind of everything honing in and amplifying that journey that they have.
Yeah, and we also thought early on too that if you're going to put people in a single location with two actors, you have to have some humor. Have to break it up. You have to have lighthearted moments, like the water bottle scene and like the scene you mentioned before about the nail clippers. It's like, because if you don't have that, it gets very serious and very navel gazing very quickly. And so let's make sure we're offering moments of levity and also kind of moments of action to through that we were able to pull off those action sequences, just so the film feels, you know, broken up in a way that there's, you know, there's dynamics, valleys, and there's hills, you know, in the story as it unwinds.
And you build in a lot of tension too. There is a lot of tension, especially as we lead into some of the action sequences. You've got Mary, who's pregnant, and she's going to be climbing up into a vent, and you're like cringing. It's like, oh my God, oh my God. Is she going to, you know, fall? Is she going to miscarry? You know, what's happening here? Mary is pretty fearless. And Dev gets to be the one who's more skittish and reaches a point he's afraid to do certain things. But you build tension, you have humor. And then, interestingly, your composer, Curtis Green. I love, early on, the score has almost some horror vibe in the motif, and that changes through the course of the film. So you start off thinking this is going to be a horror film, and I like how Curtis's music turns us on our head.
Yeah, I think Curtis was, you know, he's such a talented guy when it comes to, you know, writing and composing music for us, and it really elevates the film to, you know, another degree. And having his experience, you know, working closely with Michael Giacchino and you know, that kind of presence, I think that also helped lead into the level of experience that he has, making this film, that taking this film to the next level. You know, we workshopped it and we kind of honed it in with the themes for them. But yeah, I think it's, and we even had some of the cello that is at the end of the film was played live and recorded live, which I know sometimes, especially in the indie world, it's difficult to get any type of live musical performance throughout your score, you know.
Of course, your end credit song, Alive, that Kate Brown does. You guys really need to lean into the fact that Kate wrote and sings that song because her mother promotes her so much to all the General Hospital fans.
I don't know.
Really?
I've known Kate for years. I've known her since she was a kid because, you know, I've known Michael for a while, and Kate was roommates with Mick, when they were in their early 20s. And she was great. We gave her, like, I think a two-sentence instruction. I was like, can you help us write a song? Can it feel sort of like this? Because we wanted it to burst. Because the movie is, you know, it's hopefully people are feeling a little wrung out by the end of it because it's a lot of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just, this fierce burst of optimism at the end, you know. And and then she just walked away, and her and Charles worked on that song for a few weeks. And as soon as we heard it, we're like, yes, which is the greatest feeling in the world, you know. And it's something I think too few filmmakers do, which is hire people you like and then trust them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you'll be amazed at the degree to which they will go for you if they don't feel like they're being sort of puppeteered, you know, and they have the freedom to sort of show their talent, to explore, what you've asked of them. And I think I love the song.
I think it's great. But I was just so tickled when I saw that it was Kate who did it and who was singing it. And I'm like, oh my God, I hope they lean into and a DWF. Mention Kate. Bring in those General Hospital fans who are diehard and who love her mother.
Yeah.
So that's your bonus tip for the day, boys.
I know. I was going to say, as soon as I get off, I'm going to go on Reddit and undo the community down and let them know about it. I'm not kidding. No, it's the thing about, you know, about any film festival. Like, ultimately, the audience is your responsibility. It's not someone else's job. It's your job. So Sal and I have, you know, doing everything we can because we want the theater to be sold out. We want people to be talking about our movie, and we are the right ambassadors to do that because we're the ones who worked on it, and we owe it to everyone who worked on the film and anyone who invested in us and in the movie to, like, have a success to whatever degree we're able to bring it. So any hints, I'll take them. I'll run. I will run with them.
But Josh, I have to commend you for what you just said, that so many indie filmmakers who don't have a big PR machine behind them, many who don't even have a publicist, and for over 40 years as a critic, I've been telling indie filmmakers, a lot in your budget when you're going out on the festivals, get yourself a publicist to help get the word out. But as you very smartly said, it's up to you guys to build your audience at this level. So I fully see you guys having a full house at Dances
so.
With Films.
Good. Because we don't watch the film. We watch the audience. You know, all filmmakers watch the audience.
Yeah.
They've seen the film a thousand times. So I'm just looking forward to that experience of being able to see people see our work.
Are you going to pull a Tom Cruise and stand in the back of the theater to watch them?
That's a good question. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not. I'm definitely not going to eat popcorn the way Tom does, which is always a source of constant amusement to me. It's so funny. I years and years ago, I worked on a Mission Impossible movie, and Tom, everyone who's ever worked with Tom, is like, he's a really, you know, he's a worker, man. He'll do whatever you need him to do for the movie. And when I saw those popcorn videos pop up, I was like, this guy's never eaten popcorn before, has he? Claiming to be the world's greatest popcorn lover. And I'm like, something just doesn't line up here because he's throwing the popcorn in the air, which us pop, and I may, you'll see, if you meet me in person, you'll see I'm a popcorn eater, Deb. And we don't eat popcorn that way. We shovel it into our mouth
now,
like a hungry dog.
Now, is Dances with Films, is this the premiere for Roof?
Yes. Yeah, this is the premiere.
So, how excited are you to get into DWF New York?
I mean, I'm very excited about it. you know, mostly just because I'm excited for people to see the film, you know, and share it with the world. But this one specifically, obviously playing in Manhattan, that's an amazing opportunity, and I'm very excited.
Now, do you anticipate that you'll also be in DWFLA later this year in June, I think?
Yeah, we'd love to. The idea is to do, you know, as many festivals as we can, you know, to go through a run of festivals just so that we can travel with the film, meet people, and, you know, and the goal is always, like, how do we get the film into a place where people who aren't able to come to the theater in New York, you know, can watch it, you know, in Kansas or in Washington State or wherever they may be. So, you know, we're up for doing whatever it takes to bring the film, you know, to a spot where others can see it, whether that be a festival, whether that ultimately be, you know, a streaming site or wherever, or, you know, God willing, you know, a theatrical release somewhere where people have the opportunity to see the movie as it was intended. You know, that movie, our movie was shot with a lot of wides. You know, there's some Lawrence Arabia shots.
Yeah,
movie. Because we're like, that's how you have to make a movie the way you want to make the movie. Don't try to overthink it. Do what you're passionate about and then see how it works out. And sizing was a big question. Sal and I talked a lot about that. I talked about the sizing of the frame because we wanted it to feel bad. And we knew we had limitations because of the location. So we were trying to figure out every way possible to open the film up to audiences, to make it feel a little, you know, bigger than it may have been.
By doing that, Josh, going with a lot of wides, and it also, nobody gets really tired of looking at blue skies or fireworks at night or something like that.
Okay.
But it also makes those close-ups that much more impactful when we get them.
Yep.
When we see Dev's fingernails that have tar underneath them all around the cuticle, it's like, my God, I wouldn't want that man touching me, coming near me with the dirt on those fingers. But it's very striking when you have that contrast. And that's another one of the great things by having Jonathan as your DP, because I picked up on his work where he does work in contrast, visual contrast, that adds so much to your storytelling. Now, you shot this in Knoxville, correct?
We did.
Yep, that's right.
Any plans for a special screening in Knoxville?
We'd love to do a screening in Knoxville. We actually talked about going back to the same building, and seeing it projected on the side of the building and have the crew come back up there. So that's definitely something we'd like to do. Kurt Willis, who runs the sort of the film department for Knoxville, was such a huge help, because the movie was intended to be shot in Los Angeles. We were weeks away from shooting this movie in LA, and then there was a COVID outbreak, and then we were like, let's just wait a minute. And then, during the time we were waiting, the idea of Knoxville came up. And, you know, LA is a tricky town to shoot in because everyone wants their piece, and it gets very expensive very quickly, even for indies.
Yeah.
Whereas in Knoxville, we almost laughed when we were talking to the locations person, and they're like, we can get you this building. It's going to be $3,000. And we thought that was for a day. And no, that was for the month. and we had two floors of an office building below the roof. And honestly, Sal and I were just stunned. We're like, we'll figure it out. Because you may not, it's pretty invisible there. I don't know if you picked up on it, but this movie has well over 200 visual effect shots in it. And they are all the same shot, which is, how do we remove the Knoxville skyline and replace it with an LA skyline so that it still feels like it's in Los Angeles, which was maddening. It was a maddening task to get there. But to your earlier question, I love Knoxville, love the people of Knoxville. The crew is great. You know, they do a lot of true crime stuff there. So what you end up having is a crew base of really smart professionals who, when given the chance to make a purely narrative film, not only jump at the chance, but bring a wealth of experience and talent and spirit. And that's the other thing about John, too. Like, work aside, I love John's work, but I love John because his willingness to do anything it takes with a smile and, you know, an alignment with whatever we needed, it was always there. Like, John, we're going to need you to jump off the building for this shot. He'd be like, great, let's go. I'm going to land.
But jumping off buildings, you had safety measures in place. Let's stress that.
Yes, we definitely did.
All safety measures were in place. This is not the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote pulling off some stuff.
Yes.
No, we followed. And,
multiple pieces. There are, I think, four different pieces to that scene that were shot in different areas on the roof and on the ground, and that are purely VFX. So it was complex. Yeah.
Safety was always the number one priority with whatever we were doing up on a roof, especially in a situation like that. I think anytime an actor ever even stood on an apple box, we had a stunt coordinator there, for protections.
Yeah.
Just amazing job, guys. So I got one last question for both of you. I mean, Sal, this is your first feature directorial. You both have a wealth of experience working at Bad Robot. All of your VFX work in the past, Sal, and Josh, working with JJ. Yep. So I've got to ask each of you, what did you learn about yourselves as filmmakers and storytellers in making Roof that you can now take forward into future productions?
For me, I would say that, obviously as the director of the film, there was a little bit of clarification about what that role even is. There's a lot of, yes, there's the stuff everybody knows about telling the actors what to do, but a lot of it also, is people management, understanding your crew and getting everyone to be marching towards the same goal. Another piece was, and this was specific to Bella and Asif, they're very different actors. Mm-hmm. they look and they take direction very differently, So understanding that communication style is going to change depending on your actors, and that's a personal connection and relationship you have with them to achieve and be successful, and that's going to be different for every single actor. That was something that kind of I was able to learn and understand going into the future films that I want to make.
And what about for you, Josh?
For me, it was that this is the place I want to be. I remember when the first big movie I ever had any meaningful role in was when we were doing the reshoots for Super 8 back in 2000, whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
2010. And then, I worked on the Star Wars movies, I worked on the Trek movies, I worked on the Mission Impossible movies, and I love big movies, I love going to big movies, but as a storyteller, I realized I want to make small movies. there's a freedom in it, there's an immediacy to it, there's something about having a small crew that you know well, that you're all talking together, because the only way to mount a truly large movie is to have just so much compartmentalization and so much delegation. That's the only way those machines can move. And again, I love those movies, but I don't want to be in that world. I want to be in the world where we're making smaller movies. We have, we're telling a story that may not necessarily be what, the Sonys or the Paramounts or the Warner Brothers or the Netflixes of the world want. But, at the end of the day, your life is your choices and what's going to make you happy. And I think what I realized about Roof, what makes me happy is being right there in the middle of it and telling the exact story we want to tell and being able to do that. And then, the next movies I want to make are all like that. They're all, the idea of creating a little jewel box. It's not a lot of money, but also not a lot of risk because it's not a lot of money. And hopefully still being able, the tools today are so powerful. The idea of being able to pull off a beautifully cinematic image on an iPhone, and they'd be able to edit and color your movie in Resolve, which is free. You're like, wait a minute, what is holding us back? All the tools that I came up making independent films on 16mm film.
Mm-hmm.
There was real cost that you could not avoid. You had to pay for the film, you had to pay for the process, and you had to pay for the inner positives and the inner negatives and the negative cutting. And that was all real cost that you could not avoid. That is all gone. All that matters is the time that you're able to commit to it and the people you're able to convince to join you. And I just realized that is the place I want to play and live.
Well, from what I'm seeing from both of you with Roof, you're both playing in the proper sandbox for the stories that you want to tell. And yeah. I can't wait to see. Are you going to work together on more or go your separate ways? Do you know yet?
Sal and I all depends. Want to make together already. Yeah, it's just a question of when are things going to line up that we can do it?
Well,
we have a great one.
No matter
we have a great one.
No matter what you guys do.
We have a great story we're going to tell one day.
Well, no matter what you guys do, count me in as watching. I am really impressed with what you've done with Roof, and I really do love this film. I can't wait to hear about the audience reaction after they get to see it.
That is fun too. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for everything.
I fully expect you to get a distribution deal very quickly.
Here. Cheers to that. You own a distribution company?
No. But I'm watching this film, and I'm thinking this would be perfect for Vertical. Maybe Gravitas as an alternative and not a primary, but Vertical, I think, definitely. Even Aura Entertainment. Mm-hmm. But Vertical is the one that just leapt out at me watching this as a great fit for a distributor.
Oh, great. Good advice. Yeah.
So
I think there's a lot of opportunity. We just have to get eyes on the film and have people, you know, fall in love with it the same way that we did and how you enjoyed it, and then kind of go from there with it.
Well, my fingers are crossed, and have a wonderful, wonderful premiere at Dances with Films New York next week.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I hope I get to speak with each of you again. And if you're in DWF LA later this year, I'm sure I'll run into you there.
Oh, great.
Amazing.
That's awesome.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.